Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. George Ranier and Dr. Tom Hunt. Dr. Ranier is calling himself a medical community activist and a consultant cardiologist in today's world. He's recently tried to retire, but continues to get asked to do some work. Tom Hunt is the executive director of physician services for Providence Alaska Medical Center. Today, our topic is going to be newer developments in senior care, particularly some newer clinics that are opening up to take care of our elderly population in Anchorage. If you have questions or comments about any of the information you hear today, you're welcome to give us a call. In fact, we would encourage you to give us a call. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and we can be emailed during the next hour at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. You have to spell that out, line1@kska.org. George and Tom, welcome to Line 1. It's nice to have you guys here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Mm-hmm.
So why are we here? Let's frame the issue. Who wants to do that for us?
Well, I can do that. Right now in Anchorage, people who have Medicare for their insurance, and those are mostly people over the age of 65, are finding it to be difficult to find a physician who will be able to see them. Recently, in the paper, people may have noticed a lady called 63 physicians in town and couldn't find a single one who would take her on as a patient. And this has been a growing problem, one that federal solutions don't seem to be coming down the pike. So we're trying to make some difference in that. Both Dr. Hunt and I have worked on various ways of coming around to a solution for that. And we can talk about the details of those solutions as we go along. But the primary problem is people over the age of 65 who have Medicare are having a hard time finding a doctor.
Tom, let's flesh that out a little bit more. I'd like to know why that perhaps is an issue. And before we came on the air, you wanted us to make sure we understand that Medicare is designed for people over 65, but there's others as well that are covered by Medicare.
That's right. Nationally, approximately 18% of Medicare beneficiaries have other disabilities or chronic renal failure, qualifying them for Medicare as well. So you'll often see pediatrics patients, for example, who have severe brain injury or spinal injury who might be Medicare beneficiaries. The problem, to take it a step further, is indeed one of access to care. Access to care challenges concentrate mostly in the primary care arena, a little less so in the specialty care arena, although we're beginning to see it as well in specialties. And that comes for a variety of reasons. There is a lack of primary care physicians here in the Anchorage Bowl, more broadly in Alaska and across the country. Nationally, only about 4 or 5% of medical school graduates go into primary care careers nowadays. So there's a primary care shortage, and consequently, the primary care physicians here in town, for example, have no end of demand for their services from Medicare beneficiaries or commercially paying beneficiaries and the like. The next layer of question is really, why is it so important to get access to primary care? And what are the implications of not getting access? Because seniors who don't get access to primary care don't get their immunizations, don't get their chronic conditions well managed, and then some of their problems can escalate into requiring acute hospital-based care, specialty care, and the spend for Medicare increases. And so the overall pot of money diminishes because of that. And so it's thought that not only is it important to get access to primary care, but access to primary care in turn saves money. So the problem is twofold when looked at that way.
Why is it that physicians don't want to or can't see Medicare patients?
I think the primary reason for that is that their traditional way of practicing medicine, which has been going on for decades, certainly in this state, is such that their overhead is fairly high. Most people have an overhead of at least 50%, so that when you come in to see the doctor and you pay them $50 for the visit, $25 of that goes for paying the lights, the heat, the nurses, mm-hmm. insurance, materials, and that sort of thing. So the overhead is high, so it requires a fairly high amount of office visit payment to both pay for the overhead and leave some money around for the physician to take home and take care of his own personal needs, get the kids through school, and that sort of thing. And it turns out that the payment that Medicare pays for to a primary care physician for a office visit, for an office visit, is just not high enough to both pay the overhead and pay for the physician's time. And so the physicians who do see Medicare, many of them actually are doing it as a donation, since the Medicare payments pay for their overhead, but really not for the patient's time at all. So that basically is the reluctance for physicians to have at least too many patients who have their payment made through Medicare in their office practice.
Mm-hmm. So in this reason, they might limit the number of patients.
Right. Almost all the practices. I don't think there's a single practice in town that doesn't limit the number of Medicare patients that they will see. And they do that out of economic necessity.
Mm-hmm. I would clarify that that's true for the private practices. For the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, for example, there's no limit.
Correct.
And I was just somewhere I was in preparation today. I was going over how Medicare comes up with their payment scheme, and part of it's the amount of time and effort a physician puts in. But am I right? Is the only overhead that's considered is the malpractice costs?
No.
Is that they have an overhead?
Yes. The cost is broken down into facility cost and professional cost.
Okay.
And the facility cost, of course, includes the heat, light, nurses, etc.
Okay.
And then the professional cost is professional component is that this designed to go to the physician mm-hmm. Directly. So everything is included in the calculation of that payment that Medicare will pay for the physician's services.
Okay. I may be wrong about this, but thinking as a primary care physician myself, as a pediatrician, it seems like, you know, I have an inordinate amount of overhead. In any personal service business, I'm going to suspect and hopefully think I'm right that personnel costs are the biggest component. And in primary care, there's often an inordinate number of ancillary staff working for physicians to help get this thing done, nurses and aides and front desk staff. As I'm thinking, as opposed to a general surgeon who may do everything with himself and a receptionist at times even. So is that something that's recognized in this payment scheme, and is this complicating
the
issue?
It's not. It's not at all. Back in 1967, when Medicare was initiated, there was a cost-based reconciliation, and physicians were paid their costs. That was the rough formula. Over the years, as the spend ballooned, Medicare instituted a variety of cost-cutting measures and eventually settled on what was called the sustainable growth rate. That SGR increased by some arcane formula that few of us understand, but it does not keep pace with inflation. And so as medical practices become more complex, as you say, and the paperwork burden becomes more intense and the expectations for interventions in the office increase as opposed to what was used to be done in the hospital. Yes, you're right. Your personnel costs, your overhead costs increased such that the SGR didn't keep pace with the price of running an office practice.
Okay. So we got a couple of callers I want to take, but the bottom line here is the reason it's become an issue is the cost of seeing a patient is not being met by the Medicare reimbursement, at least in this state at this time, and that's why we're having the problem?
Essentially, that's it.
Mm-hmm. But I'll tack on two other answers. Mm-hmm. One is that, by definition, these are older humans,
right,
and they become physiologically more complex and psychologically mm-hmm. more complex, or they're disabled humans, and they're injured and so require a great deal more medical care. So these patients are more complex. And in that simple office visit, you can't get done quite as much as you can per unit of time as you might with a younger, more well population. Mm-hmm. In addition, there's a lot of work that has to be done in between visits. And technically, that's not reimbursed for by Medicare.
Right.
And then finally, there's, in an effort to control costs, Medicare has instituted a great deal of oversight. And so many physicians are reluctant to engage deeply with Medicare because they're fearful of audits or payback requirements if there's any sort of an error in the search for fraud. Mm-hmm. So that intimidates physicians, and it adds mm-hmm. to the burden, albeit not numerically, but mm-hmm. it discourages participation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we may need to come back a little bit more to this, but let's go ahead and take a call. Earl, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I've enjoyed so far the subject you're talking about, and it's very educational. I'm also wondering, since an awful lot of this is primary care, and we have a WAMI program here that encourages, is supposed to help Alaskans become medical doctors. I'm wondering if there's something in that program either to increase the number of actual primary care physicians by giving them a higher discount or something like that. And then, of course, and there's also for some states have a WICHE program. Some of the other lower 48s have a WICHE program that hooks up with Oregon. And we use that with, I think, physical therapists and dentists up here, but for some reason we haven't done it with medicine. And that would certainly increase the pool we could use from. But knowing a lot of the people who've been getting in the WAMI program, it seems to me that the review board isn't being very selective in getting people to be sure that they're going to come back. They're either not having a sufficient penalty if they don't come back to Alaska. In other words, they just have to pay off their cost, which is a giant benefit for people. If instead of having a penalty, like three times the cost of the borrowed money if they don't come back to work. So some of those things need to be dealt with, and I don't know if you'll get into that at one of your later programs.
So your issue is on another side of this equation is where we've recognized that there's an increased number. We haven't really talked about it, but there's an increased number of people qualifying for Medicare basically because of the growing population's age. Then there's this issue of decreased payment, and there's the issue you're bringing up is what about the number of providers? And those are the big three issues.
Right.
So what about provider issues? How can we get more?
Well, thank you.
I'll just take this off.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Earl.
Yeah, thanks, Earl. That's a very good question. For those who aren't familiar, WAMI stands for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. And those are the states in the Northwest which don't have medical schools of their own. So this consortium got together with the University of Washington and allows residents from each of those states to take part of their medical training in their home state. So, for instance, in Alaska, for the first year or two, Alaskan resident students can actually stay in Anchorage and do their first year of medical school training. And then they spend the next 3 years in Seattle at the University of Washington completing their training. And that training at the University of Washington is subsidized by the state of Alaska. So the University of Washington is actually Alaska's medical school, if you will. And over the years, it's been very successful in training new physicians. And a surprisingly large number of Alaskans who go through the WAMI program actually come back to the state as practicing physicians. And various proposals, I guess we would call them, have been made to the state by the WAMI program enthusiasts to make it easier economically for students to come back to the state and practice here. But it's pretty difficult to have a student, when they begin the WAMI program, know for sure exactly what kind of a specialty they're going to go into. There's a wide range of specialties out there. And they all have their attractiveness. And actually, the University of Washington has a high proportion of family practice and internal medicine graduates. But most of those get their training in other parts of the country. Some stay in Seattle for their post medical school training to become a family practice physician. Some go to other parts of the country, maybe even other parts of the world. And it has been the experience of everyone that where the post-medical school training is done largely determines where the graduate is actually going to settle. So if a medical student from Anchorage goes to through the WAMI program, does his medical school training at Washington in Seattle, then goes on to get a internal medicine residency, that may be in Boston or it may be in Dallas or whatever have you. And there's a great correlation between where that particular city training is done and the person winding up actually practicing in that location. And to help ameliorate that problem for Alaska, a family practice residency program has actually been started in the state, and we are graduating a number of students from that program every year, and it is largely based in Anchorage. So that has been a great help, actually, in bringing family practice practitioners back to the state, and many of those actually went through the WAMI program. But it is very complicated, and the state legislature has been reluctant right along to provide too much forgiveness to the students for their training to come back to the state. And we have tried, I've been on the WAMI advisory board for some time, and we've tried consistently to help with this, but so far it's pretty difficult to increase the amount of money that the state presently is paying for medical student training.
I can speak for some WAMI graduates who've chosen to return to Alaska, and I would say that the penalty forgiveness, the loan repayment forgiveness for coming back here, was part of their incentive for returning, in addition to their affection for for Alaska. But the other issue, Earl, is that a lot of these the WAMI program has no domain over what specialty a physician will choose. And I don't believe that WAMI graduates are any more likely to go into primary care than any others. And so many of those WAMI graduates we're fortunate to have in our community are specialists. And so it hasn't been able to nail the primary care access challenge the way we might hope. There are loan repayments forgiveness programs that the state's been playing with, and their most recent one has an acronym named SHARP. And that offers some even more accelerated loan repayment by going into medically underserved communities, typically off the road system. At the moment, they don't recognize most of Anchorage as being medically underserved.
So in my mind, I've identified that there's an increased number of patients. There is a decreased amount of payment going to primary care providers in particular that we've identified for Medicare. And that's true across the country, perhaps, and we're not having enough providers. So, I mean, it's kind of like the proverbial perfect storm kind of situation. But why is it more of an issue in Alaska than it appears to be in other parts of the country?
Well, I think part of the reason for that is that we have a relative fewer number of primary care physicians and internists in the Anchorage area. So we have a dearth of providers. And secondly, we in Alaska have not been through the problem, if you will, of managed care in the lower 48, where payments to physicians were severely curtailed by managed care plans down to the point that they redesigned their practice and the way they practice and how they do medical business to account for that lower payment from managed care plans, so that the amount of payment for physician services dropped to the point where it nearly matched the payment that Medicare makes. Mm-hmm. So as it turns out...
So it wasn't as painful to see a Medicare patient who's getting paid...
Exactly.
The physician's getting paid less for.
Not only that, but physicians changed the way they did their practice in the lower 48 to adapt to that lower payment. So I have friends and many people have acquaintances whose parents who are on Medicare have been taken care of in a clinic at some place in the lower 48 and have never seen a doctor. Mm-hmm. So that a lot of the care is being taken care of by nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, nurses themselves. And that actually has not taken hold in this state. Generally speaking, when you go in to see a physician's office, especially in private practice, generally you see the physician. There are plenty of nurse practitioners in town, and some of them work in offices. But by and large, you get to see the physician pretty much every time.
Another thing that you're saying dawns on me is if you're getting less and less as a provider to see patients, you've either got to cut down on your overhead or you've got to do more per unit of time. So therefore, the only way you're going to do that is you got to see more patients per unit of time, which doesn't lead, in my mind, to better health care necessarily. I'm not sure I can support that fact, but I'm just, that's my supposition here.
Well,
and that leads to more discomfort and more unhappiness by the consumer.
and the physician.
And the physician. Oh, so, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
So that's the usual formula, and simple Adam Smith all over again. It's a supply and demand, and you've got to cut your output or increase your volume.
Yeah.
But I think there's another way of looking at it, which is to expand your frame of reference. If we look at our Medicare practice as our clinic frame of reference, those four walls that define our private practice office with a few exam rooms and a receptionist and a nurse, having a large Medicare population is a losing proposition, especially compared to what you could get if you were seeing Primera or Aetna or Cigna patients. If that's your frame of reference, it's a losing proposition, and we'll never get out of this hole. The option we have, though, is to look at the total spend, the total cost for seeing Medicare patients across the continuum. So that includes the primary care, the hospital care, the nursing home care, the home health, the durable medical equipment. And if you look at that as a whole spend, and you try to organize the delivery system around that such that you can control the spend, you have an option perhaps of making money on it. And so our bias and the way we're looking at this through Providence Health Systems is to look at treating the Medicare patient, the senior Medicare patient, as a proposition that extends across this long continuum of care. And there's money to be made at some parts of the sector, in some sectors of that continuum, there's money to be lost and the rest. But overall, if you look at it with a broader frame of reference, there's a chance you'll break even. So to jump ahead to where we're going, I think what we think we're doing at Providence is seeing patients inside a system such that as they move through the system, where they get their x-rays, they get hospitalized, they move further down the road into a long-term care facility, that those transitions become easier, that care becomes easier, it becomes more rationally distributed, hopefully, such that there's savings to be had and or earnings to be had throughout that patient's continuum. And that's the way to finally lose less money on the Medicare.
to lose less money.
And I say that advisedly because what we've forged at Providence is going to lose money. There's no question about it. Yeah. But we lose less money when we subtract the monies gained through x-rays, lab fees, pharmacy fees, et cetera.
We haven't said it yet, but my understanding, and you guys are here to correct me, is that the reimbursement for primary care physicians compared to Aetna and Blue Cross and so forth, as a rule, is about two-thirds of what the insurance companies are reimbursing. Is that fair to say, or does that need more discussion also?
It probably is nearly that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All right. I tell you what. What I'm going to do now is take a break. I've tried to solve this or get a good understanding of why we've got a problem, and then we're going to spend the rest of the day hopefully talking about how to correct it and what options are available and what's being done. I know there's been one person hanging on a phone call, and I think that question is going to be addressed. So I want you to hang on, keep doing what you're doing. We'll be back shortly. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550 8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. And after this very short break, we'll continue to take calls and emails and talk with Dr. George Rainier and Tom Hunt. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. See you soon.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. George Rainier and Dr. Tom Hunt, and we're talking about the problem with Medicare and being a patient who is insured by Medicare and the difficulty in getting seen primarily in Anchorage with this problem. We've tried to, in the first part of this program, understand the issue, which is one of somewhat of a decreased reimbursement for Medicare patients versus other forms of payment, an increasing number of patients needing the care, and a decreasing number of providers. And we've touched on all of those issues. I don't think we really talked about all the reasons why there's less primary care physicians, but we'll skirt around that one and get into what's trying to be done during this period of time. You can reach us at line1@kska.org if you want to email during the next 30 minutes. Our phone number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the last thing I'm going to say is don't call or email after 7 o'clock, 7 after 8 o'clock tonight, because we won't be here. 7 to 8 is a rebroadcast. So let's take a caller. Diane, you're on line 1. What can we do for you?
Hi. Before I get into my original comment, I can't let go what you have been discussing from the prior caller, and there was something in the paper recently about one of the legislators wanting to perhaps start a medical school, and I think the desired spot, according to him, was Fairbanks, and I know that you'll talk later how that would not work with such a small population and probably may not even work at Anchorage. I think Lisa Murkowski has brought up this issue many times of how do we get more primary care doctors to take care of Alaskan Medicare patients. And in some of her events that she has held, the suggestion was that you touched on, and that is to maybe pay help pay the school costs for medical students when they if they come back here and take on a certain number of Medicare patients for a certain number of years, and hopefully that will happen sometime. But my main comment is when Dr. Rainier went to Juneau a year ago to get $1 million to start the Medicare clinic, the model was essentially that the Medicare client would be seen for about 5 minutes for, or perhaps at the most 15, mostly by nurse practitioners, and that would be for one problem only. And as you get older, that is not realistic. I know nurse practitioners who do take a Medicare clients, but they only allow that for 50% of their clientele, and that's how they survive. So I do not know how either Providence is going to do theirs, and I'm interested to hear about that, how they're going to be able to do this and still give quality care, not just for one problem only per visit, which is totally not practical. I did hear you say about, because they will order the x-rays and the labs, that they will get something back on that. But that also could lead to perhaps ordering more tests just to make the bottom line look good. So please,
right,
reflect on this, if you would.
All right, Diane, I'm going to ask you to take this your answer off the air, and you're welcome to call back if you'd like. But we'll ask Tom and George both to talk about their plans and what they're trying to do and how they're trying to meet this this issue. Thanks for your call. George, let's start with you.
Sure. Thanks for that those comments. And I'd like to comment about your comments a little bit before I launch into the plan we have for a Medicare clinic here in Anchorage. The model for the clinic is one in which much of the work which formerly is done by physicians and doesn't need to be done by physicians will actually be done by somebody else, namely nurses, physicians, assistants, medical assistants. Most of the time, you don't need the physician to spend his or her time asking the patient when was the last time they were in Mexico and how old their parents were when they passed away, and arranging and finding what their medical records look like, how many medicines they're taking, where they were in the emergency room on the last occasion. All those things which take physicians' time, which is very expensive, can actually be done by somebody else quite effectively, and nurses are very well trained for that. And in my practice as a cardiologist, our nurses did much of that work, leaving the real crux of the problem in the lap of the physician. And that's how this clinic that we propose opening here shortly is actually going to work. So the clinic is not designed to be a mill, but rather be what now is known as a medical home for the patient. The patient will be seen by the same people every time. The work which doesn't actually have to be done by a physician will be done by somebody rather than the physician. The physician will see the patient every time, will evaluate the problem, confirm the physical findings and the history as needed, make a decision about what the problem is and what to do next about the problem, and recommend make these recommendations, and then see the patient back again for follow-up as needed. Many patients have multiple problems, have very complex problems, and almost all of them are interrelated, actually, so that you get to know your patient better if you see them more than one time. It's very difficult to come to a conclusion about how their congestive heart failure, diabetes, stroke, anemia, and angina all interrelate, and they often have high blood pressure at the same time. And the treatment of one affects the treatment of the other, and the treatment of one needs to be followed up. So the intent of this clinic is to see the patient as often as is necessary in a longitudinal fashion, so the patient gets to be well known, well treated, and the follow-up of all the evaluations and medications, recommendations, and treatments can be seen in a longitudinal fashion. Actually, that is a better way, a more accurate and humane way of practicing medicine rather than trying to take care of all the problems at once and tell the patient you'll see them again in a 1 year.
Okay. And bring us up to date as to where you are before we ask Tom what the other people are doing in the city. Where are you? Is it close to opening, and where are you going to be located?
Yes. The clinic has a space now. It's on the old Seward Highway, just south of O'Malley, on the same side of the street as Lowe's is located in that area. Mm-hmm. It's a relatively new building. The space that the clinic is going to occupy has never been used before, so it's being built out as a brand new space just designed for this clinic. There'll be 12 exam rooms, rooms for the offices, nurses, front desk, billing, all those kinds of things. And the walls are actually going in as we speak. Cables are being laid. Floor coverings will be going in. Fortunately, we've had donations of lots of equipment and some cabinetry and exam tables, that sort of thing. So it's scheduled to be ready physically to open pretty much towards the end of this month. Our big problem is the same problem we've actually been talking about this whole half hour, and that is finding a primary care physician to do the work. We've been interviewing physicians from around the country, and there are very few primary care physicians or internists in the rest of the country who are interested in a new job. So we're hoping to find that person. I interviewed somebody this morning from California, and we are in the process of opening as soon as we get a physician on board and as soon as the protocols and the ways of handling patients when they come to the office and before they get to the office are worked out.
Just going to be Medicare patients?
The clinic will only see you if you have Medicare.
Okay. Tom, what's Providence doing?
We've opened January 24th. We have at this point one internist, one advanced nurse practitioner. We have some part-time help from a family physician. And we are interviewing with some others. It has been hard to find those skilled personnel. We also have some nursing staff. Now, one of the key provisions of the patient-centered medical home, as it's come to be called, is care coordination. And that's where I think the real challenge in managing complex elders arises, because there is a great deal of care coordination that needs to happen between clinician and other clinicians or durable medical equipment suppliers or hospital-based facilities. A lot of that happens in between visits. So one of the challenges is getting the staff and the team built up who can manage those things in between visits, again, so that the physician doesn't need to be the one to do it. I think George's point is well said. You do need a team around you, and those team members who are not physicians should be empowered, educated, and able to work at the top of their license and do that work, which isn't necessary that a physician do. But to respond to Diane's point, at neither extreme is Medicare viable or is senior care a viable proposition if you're seeing only one problem at a time. Patients are complex. Their problems are conjoined. But at the other extreme, spending an hour and a half or three trying to get to know a complex patient for $49 to pay your overhead is not viable either. And so there's a happy medium. What we're trying to do is build our clinic around a team-based, comprehensive, whole-person orientation that will provide those that care coordination service in between. So care coordination, to my mind, looks like this. There are registered nurses who can help make referrals, help do histories, as George points out. We intend to have a behavioral health person in our midst who can attend to those aspects of the patient's care that are behavioral and perhaps impeding the medical care. And we'll be able to hook up to the social work engine that the hospital has, because a lot of these folks need help steering between social agencies as well. Transportation becomes a problem, and we've got a little bit of extra money put aside so that we can get taxi vouchers and such for patients to get to other appointments. That sort of whole person orientation, I think, is really important to success in senior care.
We had a question on an email of somebody that's 57 years of age, not on Medicare now. Would they be able to use the Providence new clinic?
At this time, we've dedicated ourselves to seeing patients 55 and up, regardless of payer source. Practically speaking, what that means is we're really actually seeing Medicare only. But we designed ourselves as a senior care center with a geriatric emphasis, or near geriatric, if you don't mind me teasing you, Thad.
Hey. What, you think I'm not listening?
She turned away. So we defined that 55 in age or greater, mostly because there is a primary care access challenge for anybody who's getting older, and there's a near Medicare phenomenon that some of us are beginning to see, where some patients, as they approach the Medicare age, do have trouble finding Medicare or a primary provider to take them on.
Okay. Here's another email by someone like me getting closer to this age. He says, this is an interesting problem. Is there a problem in other high-cost living areas such as Hawaii? He has three questions. So is Hawaii struggling with the same issues? Yes, no, and if not, why not? Do we know?
Are you considering taking your retirement in Hawaii?
Yeah. I'm not acquainted with Hawaii, whether they have a problem or not, but it's certainly a problem in the lower 48.
Okay. Second question, I've never understood why patients just can't make up some of the difference out of pocket. What's the logic against that?
Well, the logic against that is that when Medicare was set up in 1967, they wanted Medicare to be the same for everyone. They didn't want to develop a two-tier kind of a program, one in which some Medicare patients would be able to augment their payments and therefore possibly be able to be seen by physicians, and leaving patients who couldn't augment their payments out in the cold. So it wanted to be a very egalitarian kind of a program, and consequently that's called balanced bill payment. That is federally illegal. Many physicians think that that part of the program should be repealed and allow people who could afford to help make up the difference. I know it's very interesting in Medicare. The Medicare plan actually makes you be a contributor to a person's well-being when you don't necessarily have to. For instance, if you're seeing a Medicare patient who is very wealthy and could easily afford to make up the difference, you have to basically give your time and your energy to them free of charge. But yet on the other side of the coin, if you see somebody who is indigent but has Medicare, you can't actually forgive the part of the bill that the patient is required to pay. Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So on one hand, you're mandated to be philanthropic, and on the other hand, you're mandated not to be philanthropic. It's mm-hmm. it's quite a schism.
So it's not necessarily the logic. We can argue whether it's logic. It's basically it's a law that you
it's
get
a law.
To, you got to live
a
by.
Law. Right.
Third question from this email is, if I retire and have benefits, even though Medicare becomes my primary insurance, does my secondary coverage still allow me to be seen as a, quote, regular patient, end quote?
No. Generally speaking, that does not help. Medicine and Medicare is virtually the only situation in the United States that I know where there are price controls. And so when you see a patient and your charge is $49 or whatever it happens to be, you cannot charge more than $49, even if the person's insurance was able to pay more than that. Mm-hmm. So there is a limit to how much you can charge. And that limit, of course, is what we're talking about, is too low.
I think you can charge more, you just can't accept a greater payment.
That's fraud.
It's basically a
you could charge 89, but you can only accept 49.
Right.
Okay. All right, let's take a call. Mary, you're on line one?
Yes, hi. My name's Mary, and I work with a lot of seniors, and so I'm very thankful to both of you gentlemen for the work that you're doing to increase access to primary care. It is a huge need in our state, so you're to be commended for that. My question is actually more of a comment, and it's to the point that Dr. Rainier raised about not needing a ton of time with a physician to arrive at accurate diagnosis. And I guess my question or my comment would be that in the literature that I've reviewed, since I work with seniors and on behalf of seniors, it seems to suggest that actually getting at a lot of the root causes of issues does take time, that they take longer to disclose about things like their mental health conditions or substance abuse or use or other more personal topics. And so I guess I'm wondering, how is it in your model that you plan to arrive at some of those types of issues that are maybe underneath the surface than the toothache or the, you know, gout or something that they might have originally come in to discuss, but that also might be driving up healthcare costs and other areas along the continuum of care?
I think this is an important issue, Mary, that if you don't mind, let me put a little editorial. There's very well done studies in primary care that a large percentage of what's done in primary care is primarily psychosocial in origin, and then another large portion may be medical, but the origins are psychosocial. So that really, it turns out a minority of the problems are truly I broke my wrist. I had a myocardial infarction. So you're right in that respect. And I think anybody who does primary care understands that. I think that's just to frame your question a little bit more, all right? How are you guys going to answer her question?
Well, Mary, that's a very important question and one that that every physician thinks about with every patient, actually. And physicians turn out to be students of human nature. If they're a good physician, they are a good student of human nature. And one of the things that you learn early on and you get better at it as time goes on is how to evaluate those kinds of things practically at first glance. I can't tell you how many times I've seen people who have multiple problems like you've just described. And as a student of human nature, you come to the conclusion that there are underlying psychosocial problems that give rise or exacerbate or aggravate their medical problem. So a clinic that's going to do a good job in this kind of business has to have a physician who is experienced, seasoned, has seen lots and lots of problems, both psychosocial and physical, and be able to come to a conclusion early on how much of each of these things contribute to the patient's problem and go after it. So that's going to be an important part of any clinic that does a good job, and certainly high on the list of the things that need to be done in the clinic that we're opening on Old Seward Highway.
I agree that as I grew older in my medical career, I was able to distinguish psychosocial from acute medical. But I also have to point out that the less time we spend with patients, the more we tend to spend on studies. And I think when you look again at the broader frame of reference as to where the money's going, when we just increase the number of MRIs that we order, we're not saving any money.
I'd like to comment about that, too. Yeah. As it turns out, the major driver of the cost of medicine in the United States and in the Western world is the development of technology.
New technology.
Technology.
Right.
When I came to town, if a person had a heart attack, we'd put them in the hospital, give them morphine, lidocaine, keep them at bed rest for 2 weeks, send them home to rest for another 4 weeks at home, then they went back to work. Now, when you come in with a heart attack or a myocardial infarction, you enter into a system which is highly complicated, full of all kinds of very talented individuals, surrounded by millions of dollars worth of equipment. And in 24 hours, instead of having had your completed myocardial infarction, in fact, you've had it aborted. It's been stopped by technology. You go home later on in the day, and within a week or maybe even several days, you're back at work. Now, that little piece of experience probably cost $100,000 to $200,000. And no one would want to go back to the way things were when I started practice in cardiology. But that $100,000 to $200,000 is what it costs to have the kind of technology and the kind of humane treatment we have for patients these days. And that's the cost. That cost is what's driving medical care. I would say between 60 to 80% of the increase in cost of medical care in the United States and in the Western world, including Canada and Europe, is actually an increase in the use of technology that no one would want to give up. There are many reasons for wanting to keep it and use it. But our main problem as a society is not using it, but using that technology in the best possible way and allocating it in a way which is most beneficial for our society as a whole. And no one nationally or locally actually has taken the time to try to address this problem. The new Patient Protection and Care Act totally sidestepped this problem. And so we are still left with this main problem. Technology is here to stay. It's worsening, so to speak, in the cost to us all, and we have not taken any effort and any steps to try to deal with this on a social basis.
Well, remember, part of the challenge is that we're talking today about an access problem in an outpatient care setting where technology doesn't drive the immediate care delivery. In the absence of adequate history and the time to work with a patient. I think we do tend to drive down the technology path more than time spent with a patient would otherwise dictate.
And where I was driving with that diatribe, if you will, is the fact that this increase in the total amount of expenditures for Medicare care in the United States largely is going towards technology.
Right.
And that's where the money is going, and leaving less and less money available for the primary care physician and the internist to spend time thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've gotten with Medicare, so that Medicare pays for an MRI, but it doesn't pay
to prevent
for it doesn't pay for the internist to sit down and spend time thinking about the problem and to avoid using that high technology when it's not necessary.
Yeah, I think there was some monies or an effort being made. I don't know what happened to it with Obama's health plan to evaluate the usefulness of new technologies. And there's a segment of the population, particularly political, that doesn't like that idea. So anyway, I don't know where it went, but there was some effort to look at this.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, comparative effectiveness research.
Yeah. All right. Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Diane, you still with us? All right. Well, one thing I would like to ask you guys as well is, we've talked a lot about this issue of Medicare from the physician standpoint. It's my understanding that a lot of questionnaires addressed to the recipients of Medicare have often been pretty good, that most people who have Medicare are quite happy with Medicare, at least compared to traditional indemnity insurance or medical insurance. Is that true or is that not true?
I looked up those statistics this morning, actually.
Okay. Hopefully I'm somewhere close.
No, you're very much on track. And it depends on how you ask the question, apparently. But if you ask around billing issues compared to indemnity insurance, people are delighted with their Medicare. there's far less in the copay struggle, especially with hospital care.
Okay.
Less so around service.
Okay.
There's an innumerable hassle factor around Medicare work. Satisfaction seems to be higher in the Advantage plans, which we don't see much in Alaska.
Okay.
Physician satisfaction, on the flip side, is lower with Medicare than it is with commercial insurance.
Okay. All right. We got one more caller. Let's go ahead and take Gene. You're on line one, calling from Wasilla, I believe.
Hello.
Yes. What can we do for you?
I'm enjoying your show very much. Thank you, and happy Valentine's Day. I'm a Medicaid patient, and I have extreme difficulty out in the valley getting doctors to see me. I have many different issues, but luckily I usually find a good one. And what is the difference in pay rate that a doctor gets per appointment between a Medicaid and a Medicare patient?
Oh, it's actually pretty small. I've got that in front of me here. It's
around $50 again.
Oh, well, Medicare pays about 63% of what a commercial payer pays in this community. And Medicaid is slightly more, on the order of 2 or 3% more. Not much.
Now, with all my pre-existing conditions throughout my life, and now that I'm disabled, will I have to switch over from Medicaid to Medicare at a certain age?
Yes, but I can't tell you when, which gives me opportunity actually to plug the Medicare Information Office, which you might call, Gene, at 800-478-6065.
478-6065, 1-800, okay. And so you, in your office, if you had could take more patients, you would prefer a Medicare patient or a Medicaid, or wouldn't it matter?
If I wanted to go home early?
Well, actually, Medicaid in this state is fairly well regarded by most physicians as a satisfactory payer. That's in quite contradistinction to most of the states in the lower 48, where Medicaid pays so low that most patients really have trouble finding someone who will take their case on. I know California is well known for that kind of a problem. And plus, the hassle factor is extreme. So here in Alaska, we're in pretty good shape, and the state has done a good job in trying to keep the payments to physicians and for other services for Medicaid at a high enough level so that access is not much of a problem, generally speaking.
I know several people on Medicare and Medicaid, and being on a disabled limited income, it seems like a way to reduce paperwork and money is, I think I have 11 medications a month, many of them different dates, where it's three times a month going to the pharmacy, so that my only gas money is spent on gas going to doctor's appointments in the pharmacy, where if they could give you for your conditions like 3-4 months ahead and only see the doctors if you had problems, like with diabetes, most people can control their own blood sugars. But so that seems like just a redundant sort of thing to once a month for a elderly person who's disabled to get to the post, you know, get to the pharmacy and back. It's rather silly, I think, and it keeps people totally connected to their illnesses without time or money to focus on anything else in life.
Well, I certainly empathize with you considerably. One suggestion I have is to sit down with your doctor and have them get all of the prescription dates coordinated so everything is due at the same time. Almost every physician will be able to do that, and if the physician doesn't have time, his nurse will likely do that for you. So that will save a little bit of effort.
I'll quickly challenge that. The challenge is that the average Medicare beneficiary sees 5 specialists plus a primary care physician nationally. That's from CMS statistics. So coordinating that care is harder than you think.
I mean, do people ever get healthy and get off of it, I wonder?
Yeah. Sure.
Thanks for your call, Gene.
Okay.
In the last minute, I'd like to ask George to comment. There's been a couple of emails coming in wanting to know if they go to that clinic that you're doing, are they only allowed to talk about one problem per visit?
No. That is an overstated and oversimplified attitude and understanding of how the clinic will work. Needless to say, when you come in, your entire history will be available to the nurses and the physician, and all the problems will be addressed. But major problems will be started first. Minor problems will be also probably started at the same time, or at least be evaluated. So there's no way of just taking care of one problem with one visit. Needless to say, this will be done in the most medically advantageous and satisfactory way.
All right. Thanks very much for taking the time. So we're going to have some more options. We didn't mention the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, which is also certainly able to see some Medicare patients as well. Thanks to Tom Hunt and George Rainier. Thanks very much for your time and helping us understand this.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Thad.
Line Region 1 is going to return again in 3 weeks. We'll be gone for a couple of weeks. Our guest will be Anchorage urologist Dr. Bill Clark. Why don't you join us Monday, March 7th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1, and we'll examine the newest information on prostate cancer. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program and handled all those phone calls. Thanks for listening, especially those of you who took the time to contact us. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.